I'm a sick man. I'm a spiteful man. I'm an unattractive man. I believe my liver is diseased. However, I know nothing at all about my disease and do not know for certain what ails me. I don't consult a doctor for it, never have, though I have a respect for medicine and doctors. Besides, I'm extremely superstitious. Sufficiently so to respect medicine anyway. No, I refuse to consult a doctor from spite. That you probably will not understand. Well, I understand it, though. Of course, I can't explain who it is precisely that I am annoying in this case by my spite. I'm perfectly well aware that I cannot hurt the doctors by not consulting them. I know better than anyone that by all this I am only injuring myself and no one else. My liver is bad. Well, let it get worse. I've been going on like that for a long time. 20 years. Now I'm 40. I used to be in the government service, but I'm no longer. I was a spiteful official. I was rude and took pleasure in being so. I did not take bribes, you see, so I was bound to find a recompense in that at least. When petitioners used to come for information at the table at which I sat, I used to gnash my teeth at them and felt intense enjoyment when I succeeded in making anybody unhappy. I almost always did succeed. For the most part, they were all timid people. Of course, they were petitioners. But of the uppish ones, there was one officer in particular I could not endure. He simply would not be humble and clanked his sword in a disgusting way. I carried on a feud with him for 18 months over that sword. At last, I got the better of him. He stopped clanking it. That happened in my youth, though. But you know, gentlemen, what was the chief point about my spite? Why, the whole point, the real sting of it, lay in the fact that continually, even in the moment of the acutest spleen, I was inwardly conscious with shame that I was not only not a spiteful, but not even an embittered man, that I was simply scaring sparrows at random and amusing myself by it. I might foam at the mouth, but bring me a doll to play with, give me a cup of tea with sugar in it, and maybe I should be appeased. I might even be genuinely touched, though probably I should grind my teeth at myself afterwards, lie awake at nights with shame for months after. That was my way. I was lying when I said just now that I was a spiteful official. I was lying from spite. I was simply amusing myself with the petitioners and with the officer. And in reality, I never could become spiteful. I was conscious every moment in myself of many, very many elements absolutely opposite to that. I felt them positively swarming in me, these opposite elements. I knew that they had been swarming in me all my life and craving some outlet from me. But I wouldn't let them, purposely wouldn't let them come out. They tormented me till I was ashamed. They drove me to convulsions and sickened me. At last, how they sickened me. Now, are you not fancying, gentlemen, that I'm expressing remorse for something now? That I'm asking your forgiveness for something? I'm sure you're fancying that. However, I assure you, I don't care if you are. It was not only that I could not become spiteful. I didn't know how to become anything. Neither spiteful nor kind, neither a rascal nor an honest man, neither a hero nor an insect. Now I'm living out my life in my corner, taunting myself with a spiteful and useless consolation that an intelligent man cannot become anything seriously, and it is only the fool who becomes anything. Yes, A man in the 19th century must and morally ought to be preeminently a characterless creature. A man of character, an active man, is preeminently a limited creature. That's my conviction of 40 years. I'm 40 years old now. And you know, 40 years is a whole lifetime. You know, it's extreme old age. To live longer than 40 years is bad manners, vulgar, immoral. Who does live beyond 40? I'll tell you who do. Fools and worthless fellows. I tell all old men that to their faces. All these venerable old men, all these silver-haired and reverend seniors. I tell the whole world that to its face. I have a right to say so, for I shall go on living to 60 myself, to 70, to 80. Wait until I catch my breath. You imagine, no doubt, gentlemen, that I want to amuse you. You're mistaken in that, too. I am by no means such a mirthful person as you may imagine. However, irritated by all this babble, and I feel that you are irritated, you think fit to ask me, who am I? Then my answer is, I'm a collegiate assessor. I was in the civil service that I might have something to eat, and solely for that reason. And when last year a distant relation left me 6,000 rubles in his will, I immediately retired from the service and settled down in my corner. I used to live in this corner before, but now I've settled down in it. My room is a wretched, horrid one in the outskirts of the town. My servant is an old countrywoman, ill-natured from stupidity. And moreover, there's always a nasty smell about her. I'm told that the Petersburg climate is bad for me and that with my small means, it's very expensive to live in Petersburg. I know all that better than all these sage and experienced counselors and monitors. But I am remaining in Petersburg. I'm not going away from Petersburg. I'm not going away because... No, it's absolutely no matter whether I'm going away or not going away. What can a decent man speak of with most pleasure? Answer, of himself. Well, so I'll talk about myself. I want now to tell you, gentlemen, whether you care to hear it or not, why I could not even become an insect. I tell you solemnly that I've many times tried to become an insect, but I wasn't equal even to that. I swear, gentlemen, that to be too conscious is an illness, a real thoroughgoing illness. For man's everyday needs, it would have been quite enough to have the ordinary human consciousness. That is, half or a quarter of the amount which falls to the lot of a cultivated man of our unhappy 19th century, especially one who has the fatal ill luck to inhabit Petersburg, the most theoretical and intentional town in the whole world. There are intentional and unintentional towns. It would have been quite enough, for instance, to have the consciousness by which all so-called direct persons and men of action live. I'm firmly persuaded that a great deal of consciousness, every sort of consciousness, in fact, is a disease. Ah, but let's leave that for a minute. Tell me this. Why does it happen that at the very moments when I'm most capable of feeling every refinement of all that is good and beautiful, as they used to say at one time, it would, as though of design, happen to me not only to feel, but to do such ugly things, such that, well, in short, actions that all perhaps commit, but which as though purposely occurred to me at the very time when I was most conscious that they ought not to be committed. The more conscious I was of goodness and of all that was good and beautiful, the more deeply I sank into my mire and the more ready I was to sink in it altogether. I got to the point of feeling a sort of secret, abnormal, despicable enjoyment in returning home to my corner on some disgusting Petersburg night, acutely conscious that day I had committed a loathsome action again, that what was done could never be undone. And secretly, inwardly gnawing at myself for it, tearing and consuming myself, till at last the bitterness turned into a sort of shameful, accursed sweetness. And at last, into positive, real enjoyment. Yes, into enjoyment. Into enjoyment, I insist upon that. I've spoken of this because I keep wanting to know for a fact whether other people feel such enjoyment. I'll explain. The enjoyment was just from the too intense consciousness of one's own degradation. It was from feeling oneself that one had reached the last barrier, that it was horrible, but that it could not be otherwise, that there was no escape for you. And the worst of it was, and the root of it all, that it was all in accord with the normal fundamental laws of overacute consciousness and with the inertia that was the direct result of those laws, and that consequently one was not only unable to change but could do absolutely nothing. Thus it would follow, as the result of acute consciousness, that one is not to blame in being a scoundrel, as though that were any consolation. Bad enough. I've talked a lot of nonsense, but what have I explained? But I will explain it. I'll get to the bottom of it. I, for instance, am very sensitive. I'm as suspicious and prone to take offense as a humpback or a dwarf. But upon my word, I sometimes have had moments when, if I had happened to be slapped in the face, I should perhaps have been positively glad of it. I say in earnest that I should probably have been able to discover, even in that, a peculiar sort of enjoyment. The enjoyment, of course, of despair. But in despair, there are the most intense enjoyments, especially when one is very acutely conscious of the hopelessness of one's position. When one is slapped in the face, why then, the consciousness of being rubbed into a pulp would positively overwhelm one. The worst of it is, look at it which way one will, it still turns out that I was always the most to blame in everything. And what is most humiliating of all, to blame for no fault of my own, but, so to say, through the laws of nature. In the first place, to blame because I'm cleverer than any of the people surrounding me. I've always considered myself cleverer than any of the people surrounding me. And sometimes, would you believe it, I've been positively ashamed of it? At any rate, I have, all my life, as it were, turned my eyes away and never could look people straight in the face. To blame, finally, because even if I had had magnanimity, I should only have had more suffering from the sense of its uselessness. I should certainly have never been able to do anything from being magnanimous, neither to forgive, for my assailant should perhaps have slapped me from the laws of nature, and one cannot forgive the laws of nature, nor to forget, for even if it were owing to the laws of nature, well, it's insulting all the same. Finally, even if I had wanted to be anything but magnanimous, had desired, on the contrary, to revenge myself on my assailant, I could not have revenged myself on anyone for anything, because I should certainly never have made up my mind to do anything, even if I'd been able to. Why should I not have made up my mind? About that in particular, I want to say a few words. With people who know how to revenge themselves and to stand up for themselves in general, how is it done? Why, when they're possessed, let's suppose, by the feeling of revenge, then for the time there's nothing else but that feeling left in their whole being. Such a gentleman simply dashes straight for his object like an infuriated bull with its horns down, and nothing but a wall will stop him. Oh, by the way, facing the wall, such gentlemen, that is, the direct persons and men of action, are genuinely nonplussed. For them, a wall is not an evasion, as for us people who think and consequently do nothing. It is not an excuse for turning aside, an excuse for which we are always very glad, though we scarcely believe in it ourselves as a rule. Now, they're nonplussed in all sincerity. The wall has for them something tranquilizing, morally soothing, final. Maybe even something mysterious. Well, such a direct person I regard as the real normal man, as his tender mother nature wished to see him when she graciously brought him into being on the earth. I envy such a man till I'm green in the face. He's stupid. I'm not disputing that. But perhaps the normal man should be stupid. How do you know? Perhaps it's very beautiful, in fact. And I'm more persuaded of that suspicion by the fact that if you take, for instance, the antithesis of the normal man, that is, the man of acute consciousness, who has come, of course, not out of the lap of nature, but out of a test tube. This is almost mysticism, gentlemen, but I suspect this, too. This test tube-made man is sometimes so nonplussed in the presence of his antithesis that with all his exaggerated consciousness, he genuinely thinks of himself as a mouse and not as a man. It may be an acutely conscious mouse, yet it's a mouse, while the other is a man, and therefore, etc., etc. And the worst of it is, he himself, his very own self, looks on himself as a mouse. No one asks him to do so, and that's an important point. Now, let's look at this mouse in action. Let us suppose, for instance, that it feels insulted too. And it almost always does feel insulted. And wants to revenge itself too. Apart from the one fundamental nastiness the luckless mouse succeeds in creating around it, so many other nastinesses in the form of doubts and questions adds to the one question so many unsettled questions, that there inevitably works up around it a sort of fatal brew, a stinking mess made up of its doubts, emotions, and of the contempt spat upon it by the direct men of action who stand solemnly about it as judges and arbitrators, laughing at it till their healthy sides ache. Of course, the only thing left for it is to dismiss all that with a wave of its paw, and with a smile of assumed contempt in which it does not even itself believe, creep ignominiously into its mouse hole. There, in its nasty, stinking underground home, our insulted, crushed, and ridiculed mouse promptly becomes absorbed in cold, malignant, and above all, everlasting spite. For 40 years together, it will remember its injury down to the smallest, most ignominious details. And every time it will add of itself details still more ignominious, spitefully teasing and tormenting itself with its own imagination. It will itself be ashamed of its imaginings, but yet it will recall it all. It will go over and over every detail. It will invent unheard-of things against itself, pretending that those things might happen, and will forgive nothing. Maybe it'll begin to revenge itself, too, but as it were, piecemeal, in trivial ways, from behind the stove, incognito, without believing either in its own right to vengeance or in the success of its revenge, knowing that from all its efforts at revenge, it will suffer 100 times more than he on whom it revenges itself, who will most probably not even notice. On its deathbed, it will recall it all over again, with interest accumulated over all the years and... But it is just in that cold, abominable, half-despair, half-belief, in that conscious burying oneself alive for grief in the underworld for 40 years, in that acutely recognized and yet partly doubtful hopelessness of one's position. In that hell of unsatisfied desires turned inward. In that fever of oscillations, of resolutions determined forever and repented of again a minute later. At the savor of that strange enjoyment of which I've spoken lies. It's so subtle, so difficult of analysis, that persons who are a little limited, or even simply persons of strong nerves, will not understand a single atom of it. Possibly, you will add on your own account with a grin, people will not understand it either who have never received a slap in the face. And in that way, you will politely hint to me that I too, perhaps, have had the experience of a slap in the face in my life. And so I speak as one who knows. But set your minds at rest, gentlemen. I have not received a slap in the face, though it's absolutely a matter of indifference to me what you may think about it. Possibly I even regret myself that I have given so few slaps in the face during my life. But enough. Not another word on that subject of such extreme interest to you. You'll be finding enjoyment in toothache next, you cry with a laugh, huh? Well, even in toothache there's enjoyment, I answer. You laugh? Delighted? My jokes, gentlemen, are of course in bad taste, jerky, involved, lacking self-confidence. But of course that's because I don't respect myself. Can a man of perception respect himself at all?